There was a party. There was a UK football player that had been shot.
He's killed on his birthday.
I was like, it's who? That can't happen. Why him?
No one saw a thing.
It's at night, it's dark, nobody knows where the bullet comes from.
Nothing is making it any easier.
If you don't have a motive, it's hard to know which direction to go.
We were just never gonna know.
But someone knew.
She called me and said, I think I know something about a murder.
We never could find out why Trent was killed because it was something this weird. She became the key.
Would she also become the next victim?
She was scared to death to confront him. She knew what he was capable of.
And thus she was terrified.
A woman solves a mystery and then vanishes. I'm Lester Holt, and this is Dateline. Here's Keith Morrison with The Motive.
Her heart was on fire. Lost to her, the canned music, the hum of other voices in the bar. There was only him. They were in the deep end now. And as lovers in the flush of new commitment sometimes do, they confessed their sins of the abandoned past, the worst things they'd ever done. Words, just words, best forgotten, until they could no longer be ignored.
Lexington, Kentucky. 1 year before that night in the bar.
A house where students live. And the music and laughter and chatter of a birthday party swelled and ebbed and drifted in and out of the evening air.
It wasn't a huge party. It was just a low-key party with some good friends.
They were about to be seniors, the young men who rented the place, who'd hosted the party.
We had a group of guys, four guys, that got along extremely well.
They were big men on campus. They played football, the University of Kentucky's beloved Wildcats. Antonio O'Farrell was a quarterback.
In Lexington, Kentucky, if you play for the Cats, you're pretty much a well-known entity.
The birthday boy, 21 years old, was a true rarity, a Wildcats walk-on. He had no scholarship, no invitation. He just showed up, tried out for the team.
Go!
And over 3 years of hard work, he had earned a starting position.
Here we go, boo! Go off it!
Trent DeGiro, gentle giant.
You know, everybody called him a big teddy bear. He was the great protector of all of our friends.
The party was sweet, informal. Friends snapped pictures and evening dawdled into night. It was after midnight when the party wound down.
I think we turned in somewhere between 12:30 and 1 o'clock.
Antonio and his girlfriend went to bed. Outside, Trent and some of the others settled under the light on the front porch. Out there, beyond the streetlights, was impenetrable dark. Inside,
we were already in a faint sleep, and we heard a loud bang.
One of them must have slammed the screen door. But no.
But within 10 seconds, you started to hear the chaos outside. The screaming, the yelling, the crying.
And there was Trent, slumped to one side in his chair under the light.
Trent was bleeding out of his ears and his eyes and his nose and his mouth, and it was a horrific scene.
Horrific and confusing. That loud bang had been a gunshot. But from where? Somewhere out there in the dark? Had someone intentionally fired a gun at their gentle giant, their teddy bear? In their panic and distress, they did not understand. How could they? The nature of the mystery launched here. Or who, in a haze of love, may have learned the answer.
He was just so senseless. Once you found out why, it was even worse.
Just who was Trent DeGiro, the target?
We all started hanging out from first grade, 6 years old. That's pretty neat. Yeah.
Peyton Turner and Shara Lee Bollinger were his lifelong friends.
You know? If you were his friend, you were his friend, and that's all that mattered. It wasn't a group for him. Yeah, there was no group. Everybody got treated just the same.
Trent was in fourth grade when he started playing football in his hometown of Goshen, Kentucky, just outside Louisville. By high school, he was captain of the team, had lots of friends. So popular, Trent was homecoming king with Cheryl Lee, his queen.
It was pretty special. I mean, just to be part of that and to be voted as that, and then especially with Trent.
When it came time for college, Trent set his sights high. He turned down football scholarships to smaller schools.
At one point, he says, you know what? I just got to know if I can play in the big time in a Division I school.
Mike DeGiro is Trent's dad.
So he walked on to the University of Kentucky, which is in the Southeast Conference, which is about as big as it comes. And he worked real hard to get to where he was.
And Trent's teammates saw that hard work.
Trent had the ability to perform. So while he might have been a walk-on, his performance allowed him to endear himself to others very quickly.
That July, as Trent practiced football and prepared for his senior year, his parents went to Lexington to see him and to talk about his future.
He was trying to decide what he wanted to do with his life. He was talking about maybe going to law school or business school.
Did he talk about his birthday celebration?
We knew he was going to have some kind of a thing, and then he was supposed to come home that next day to celebrate birthday with us. And never made it.
No, and a creeping fear washed over the University of Kentucky football team. Was a killer targeting them? And if so, who would be next?
When we return, the investigation begins.
Everyone talked, but they didn't see anything.
And was there more terror to come?
We were so nervous driving down the street at practice, thinking that there might be someone in the woods who wants to take you out.
Chaos is what there was on Trent DeGiro's front porch. His friends stood over the body and stared out into the dark with a kind of anticipating horror.
You're concerned that there's more to come. You know, that was one shot. Is there someone who's going to shoot again?
Trent was officially pronounced dead at 3 a.m., just about the time Don Evans arrived. Evans has retired now, but was a rookie detective back then. This was his first homicide case.
What'd you find when you got here?
There were three young men in this very yard, and they just looked distraught, and they were consoling each other.
On the porch, Trent's chair was turned over, and Evans could see blood and debris left by the ambulance crew.
What was your first idea of what appeared to have happened here?
You know, when I first walked up, I went with what appeared to be the obvious, that someone had simply walked from the side of the house, fired the shot, and then exited back toward the rear of the house. So this is almost like an alley here. So it's like, well, it would provide concealment.
Take advantage of surprise.
Yeah, if someone was going to take a shot, that made the most sense.
Believing the shot came from a handgun, police looked for shell casings. And yet for all they looked, there were none, nor any other evidence. Still, Detective Evans figured there was a party that night, so there were bound to be people who saw something.
My thought was, as soon as I get them to headquarters and get them separated, someone's going to tell me what happened.
Did they talk?
Everyone talked, but with each and every person that I talked to, they didn't see anything.
80 miles away, at 5 a.m., the DeGiro's phone rang.
It's numbing. It's hard to imagine the feeling.
And suddenly your life doesn't make sense anymore.
It absolutely stops and pivots in an instant. And then it was kind of, you know, now what?
And soon everybody knew.
I couldn't even believe it. I didn't understand it. Who would murder somebody so wonderful?
It was about then that the first really useful evidence came back from the medical examiner. Bullet fragments were recovered in the autopsy. And the ballistics showed it wasn't a handgun at all that killed Trent. It was a rifle, which turned Detective Evans' first theory upside down.
Well, the theory about walking up the side of the house and firing the shot.
That goes out the window.
That's probably out the window. The rifle's not designed for a close-range shot.
Officers canvassed the neighborhood. A woman who lived across the street said she awoke to a loud noise. And it sounded like it was right outside her house.
So based on that, we actually took one of our marksmen from the police department
and ask him, could this shot be made from here, from this angle? And we literally reenacted that possibility.
Did it make sense, the location you found?
It did make sense. We didn't eliminate the possibility that something else could occur, but this looked pretty strong to us.
So, a working theory that Trent was shot from across the street. Ballistics suggested it was a rifle with a particular and uncommon type of barrel. But who owned it? Why did he or she shoot Trent? No idea. The football team entered a world of dread. Was some hater targeting the team? Was one of them next?
We were so nervous. We were so uncertain of what happened that night that it affected our daily lives. Driving down the street at practice, thinking that there might be someone in the woods who wants to take you out.
But days and weeks and months went by. Nothing happened. And over time, the fear eroded. But the investigation went nowhere.
Did you ever get to the place where you thought, we'll just have to live with this uncertainty for the rest of our lives?
I would say 4 years into it, it's like, doesn't make any difference.
Yeah, not going to bring it back.
It's not going to bring Trent back, but still, it's, why did this happen?
You're 4 years in, 5 years in, and really no closer to solving it than from
your first case. And
day one. That will make you doubt yourself.
And then one day, a particular woman happened to see an anniversary story about the unsolved murder of the football player back in Kentucky. A woman who'd once sat in a bar in a fog of love and who now was quite terrified.
Coming up, an ex-lover reveals all, including a hard-to-believe motive for murder.
This could be the reason that we never could find out why Trent was killed is because it was something this weird.
When Dateline continues.
It wasn't as if a successful investigation could somehow undo what happened to Trent DeGiro. And yet, the lack of any answer, year after year, seemed somehow to be an insult to all that was good, and they just had to accept it.
I think we'd all kind of resigned ourselves as every year passed. We were just never going to know.
Then, it was about 5 years after the shooting, a local attorney named Tom Bullock heard from an old friend, a woman. She was nervous, tentative, asked him on the phone, could she reveal what she knew about a crime without saying who she was?
She was extremely evasive. She didn't really want to tell me really anything.
But she kept calling. Finally, she revealed it. She was calling about a murder.
Did she tell you what murder?
She eventually came around to say it was a very high-profile murder.
Would you mind go when you heard that?
I knew which one it was.
And then she told him a very strange story. Happened in a bar, she said, almost a year after Trent DeGiro was killed. She was falling hard for a guy.
They talked about how much they loved each other. Towards the end of the evening, they decided to say, okay, what is the worst thing that you've done?
Like, let's get this out of the way.
Let's just get to it, you know? That sort of point in the relationship where you say, let me hear the worst.
And her boyfriend said, I killed Trent DeGiro.
And at first, she sort of sloughed it off, you know? Sure you did.
Didn't believe him.
Nah, of course not. But then he started describing it. You know, exactly how he did it.
But she still didn't want to believe it. After all, she'd fallen in love with the guy. So she said she kind of buried it, stayed with him for another year. But now, years later and single again, she had seen a story in the newspaper about the fifth anniversary of Trent's murder, in which Trent's dad was quoted, "Somebody knows what happened."
She started really thinking about it, and it touched her.
But she was so frightened of him, she said. She was determined to remain anonymous.
They know each other intimately.
she knows how he would react to certain situations.
Yep.
And she was terrified.
He certainly would have remembered his conversations with her.
If you told someone that you committed a murder, you would certainly remember having told them that.
Yes. So Tom Bullock went to Detective Evans.
We agreed that whatever information I would give him would be anonymous. Because for all we know, the whole thing could have been hogwash.
Well, that's sort of tricky, isn't it? I mean, when you've got somebody making an accusation, you have to be able to talk to that person.
Well, yeah, but at that point, beggars can't be choosers.
So he gave you a name.
So he gave me a name. He gave me the name of Shane Ragland.
Shane Ragland, the woman's ex-boyfriend. But who was he? Didn't take long to find out. Shane was the son of a wealthy businessman. Just so happened, Shane attended the University of Kentucky at the very same time as Trent DeGiro. But after college, he didn't do so well. He ran up at least a dozen convictions, drug charges, multiple DUIs, and so on. So Detective Evans went back to Attorney Bullock.
Is there any more? Can you get me any more? And ultimately, he started talking about a motive.
And that's when the whole story took a turn into the Twilight Zone.
He told me that it was concerning Shane Ragland being blackballed from a fraternity.
What'd you think when you heard that?
That's a stupid reason to kill somebody.
The fraternity in question was Sigma Alpha Epsilon, SAE. Detective Evans looked through SAE's records. And there it was, a pledge list with Shane's name crossed off.
And then it hit. This could be the reason that we never could find out why Trent was killed, is because it was something this weird.
Evans went to one of Trent's closest friends and asked, had he heard of this guy, Shane Ragland?
And he said, Shane Ragland. And then I could just sort of see it at that point on his face, you know. And I let him tell the story.
A story about an unpleasant little incident. Shane was among the freshmen pledging the SAE fraternity. And one day, as they were getting to know the campus,
they went into Trent's dorm, and Trent was there. And on the wall was a calendar of some sorority girls.
When Shane saw that calendar, right away he pointed to one of the girls' pictures, and he bragged that he'd had sex with her.
What Shane didn't know is that girl was the girlfriend of the president of the fraternity.
Trent did not like that one bit. Got word to the SAE president. And that's when Shane was blackballed.
So at that point, Shane's opportunity to be in that fraternity is pretty much over.
The motives for murder are many and varied. But this seemed absurd. It was 3 years after that slight, when Trent was murdered in cold blood. Could it really have festered so long? And if it had, if that was true, they had another problem.
The more that we dug specifically into Shane Ragland, the more the likelihood that he would get word that he was becoming a suspect in this case. And if that happened, this anonymous witness was in real danger.
Evans had no doubt that Shane would remember he told an ex-girlfriend about the murder.
And what's going to keep him from then going up and eliminating her like he did Trent DeGiro?
So now Evans understood his mystery witness was trying to be brave, but was quite reasonably frightened. How would he ever convince her to take the ultimate risk?
She was very hesitant to do it, and she was scared to death to confront him.
Coming up, setting a trap.
Something's been bothering me. Something that you told me a long time ago.
But who's going to get caught?
I'm answering questions. You're not setting me up, are you?
Detective Evans knew he had to meet this mystery woman. A woman who was claiming she knew what happened to Trent DeGiro, but was too frightened to talk about it. Then finally, with attorney Tom Bullock playing gatekeeper, they made a deal to at least meet face to face. But any more than that? Maybe not.
and was like, listen, don't get me involved in this.
Yeah.
This guy's dangerous. So until you get handcuffs on him, you can't involve me.
But Evans knew, even if he did arrest the guy, a mystery woman testifying about something an ex-boyfriend told her wouldn't be enough.
I can imagine a prosecutor saying, well, I can't just put her on the stand. Some of his attorney will come along and say she's full of it.
You know? And in this particular case, it's, yeah, you know what? That in itself is not going to do it, nor should it. We're still in a situation where this has to come from him.
Him, meaning Shane Ragland. Evans told her they had to find a way to get Shane to admit on tape what he did. Otherwise, what jury would buy such a ludicrous motive for murder? There was only one way, he told her. She'd have to wear a wire.
She wasn't very happy with that, obviously.
I should think not.
She asked me if I could spell anonymous.
But, he said, she came around.
She wanted to do what's right all along. She just would like to do that without getting herself killed doing it.
But she would only proceed on one condition.
I had to prove why she was going to be safe. I had to prove how we were going to do this. It wasn't enough for me to say, oh, don't worry, he won't have a gun. We'll look for bulges.
So they came up with a plan. Gave her a cover story to protect her, a fictitious job, a phony address. And then, casually, she resumed contact with Shane. A few emails, a little flirty at times on both ends.
People sometimes hear from their exes, right? I mean, that happens.
And finally, the sting. She told Shane she'd be passing through the Lexington airport on business, and he agreed to meet her. It was in this airport lounge, surrounded by undercover cops and FBI, and behind security to be sure Shane wasn't armed.
What's been happening?
About 2 years in Louisville.
They reminisced for an hour or so.
Tell me the good things that you remember about our relationship.
Something that used to love your disco music.
And then she went for it.
Something's been bothering me. Something that you told me a long time ago. I wish you never had. And I need to know how you feel about it now. So I can understand what kind of person you are now.
At that point, he paused. And it's like he knew exactly what she was talking about.
I regret it.
You do now? You did it before. And you know what? Not knowing him, I just kind of ignored it all the time.
Saying Trent's name was deliberate.
We talked to her about that. And let's make sure we know what you're talking about when we play this for a jury later.
And she brought up what appeared to be the motive, that fraternity blackballing.
How could you be mad somebody to do that over something stupid? Do you ever think about it? I'm sorry, but this is something I have to get off my chest because I have to live with it too, you know? I mean, do you plan on ever telling anybody about what you did?
Was he sensing something? The cops, knowing they didn't quite have what they needed, not yet, held their breath and listened.
Let me ask you a question. You're not setting me apart.
I've never told anybody.
No, I'm just
getting this for your body. I've never told anybody.
He said, are you setting me up? And that's when things got really scary.
But she kept her cool. And they did. And then, about 10 minutes later, Shane came back with just what the detectives needed to hear.
She made him so confident and comfortable that he came back to the subject and left us with what we really needed at that point. It came out of his own mouth.
They picked him up the next day, took him downtown, asked him, was it true what an old girlfriend was telling them?
So if she tells us you sit there and you talk about the murder, she's a liar, basically. Because it never happened.
She's just making that up to think she's mad at
100%. Absolutely. There was absolutely nothing said.
Shane denied it all. Denied knowing Trent. Didn't even know where he lived. Denied talking about Trent with her.
I never mentioned his name once, and she never mentioned his name. And it's nothing about that. Nothing about the murder
or anything.
So then, His inquisitors fetched the airport recording.
I'm going to play something here for you, and I want you to listen to it, okay?
Something's been bothering me. Something that you told me a long time ago. I wish you never had.
You telling me that you didn't talk about Trent? That's not the truth, is it?
She might have said Trent. We were talking about stuff, but I didn't hear her say Trent. I didn't talk about Trent. I swear to you guys, I did not do this.
But his denials were to no avail. Shane Ragland was charged with murder. Bail was set, and Shane's wealthy father paid it. $1 million cash, so Shane was free pending trial. Which was a very big problem for the ex-girlfriend who turned him in. Police moved her to a secure location, kept an eye on her. And then, strange things started happening.
We got information from our state police intelligence section that there was a hit out on this girl. There were phone calls to her friends that would ask, have you seen her? Do you know where she is these days? Obviously trying to locate her.
And with all that going on, she had to do precisely what she didn't want to do. Go public, show herself, and testify. And the world would know that her name was Amy Lloyd, and that she was truly terrified.
Coming up, Amy goes public for the first time, facing her fears and Shane.
He told me that he shot him.
And the defense hits back hard.
If in fact someone had actually told you they had engaged in a killing of another person and you continue a romantic relationship with them, that seems a bit odd.
When Dateline continues.
If there was any doubt how seriously police took perceived threats to Amy Lloyd's security, this put it to rest. Amy rushed into court by a SWAT team. But Trent DeGiro's dad, Mike, knew that if she braved the danger and told her story...
I don't know how a jury could sort of not convict him.
But when it came time for trial... Then prosecutor, now DA, Luanna Redcorn, was all too aware she was alleging a very hard-to-believe motive.
I think I was like everybody else, a little incredulous that somebody would let the fact that they'd been blackballed from a fraternity fester for years and culminate in killing the person they blamed on blackballing them.
Mind you, they had a bit more than just Amy. They'd found what they believed was the murder weapon, a .243 Weatherby rifle, at Shane's mother's house. And at his father's place, they found .243 caliber bullets like these. An FBI expert said testing had linked those bullets to the fragments from the fatal bullet. The defense argued the tests were not reliable science.
Call your next witness.
Amy Lloyd.
And now... Nearly 8 years after Trent was killed, here was the one person who could tell the story. Amy Lloyd finally revealed herself publicly. Though, because she remains frightened even now, we've obscured her image in this video, recorded by the court. The prosecution's star witness talked about that night in a bar, and Shane, according to her, straight out confessing to murder.
He said something about how he had, if I remember, the football player... who'd been killed and told me his name, Trent. He told me that he shot him.
But Prosecutor Redcorn knew Amy's story had a weakness, and so no choice but to confront it.
You did not break off the relationship after he said this to you?
No.
You didn't go to the police or anything?
No, I ignored it.
Just ignored what he had said to you?
Right. I forgot about it. I didn't want to listen to it. I didn't want to hear it. I didn't want to believe it.
Why? Because she was in love with him, she said. During Amy's testimony, the prosecutor played the tape, the sting meeting at the airport.
Why are you so stupid?
I was angry at him. I made the wrong decision.
That, said the prosecutor, clear as day, was an admission that he did indeed commit the murder. How to defend against that? Shane's father hired a formidable defense team. Guthrie True was one of Shane's lawyers.
If in fact someone had actually told you they had engaged in a killing of another person and you continue a romantic relationship with them. That seems a bit odd.
When the defense cross-examined Amy, she knew it was coming, had to, an attack on her credibility. But could she have suspected how personal it would be? This from True's co-counsel when Amy said she went home with Shane that night after he talked about killing someone.
Weren't you concerned about spending the night with somebody who had admitted to you that he had killed someone else?
I blocked it from my mind. I didn't want to hear that.
And then a kind of nervous embarrassment filled the courtroom. The defense had gotten access to Amy's very personal, very explicit diary and confronted her with her entries, one by X-rated one.
We are trying to challenge the credibility of the prosecution's case, and sometimes that gets uncomfortable.
This is what Amy wrote the day after she said Shane confessed to her to murder.
April the 30th, the very next day, you make a notation, made love in afternoon. Great day.
We have, for the sake of decency, left out the most explicit entries made public by the defense that day.
And then May the 3rd was the date that you recorded you took a bath together and made love. Right?
Yes.
And then it was on May the 7th you notated, you noted, great love, decided I would move in with him in July. Perfect.
Yes.
So this man who had told you that he had killed someone, you made the decision that you were going to move in with him come July.
Yes.
So was her credibility harmed? There was still, after all, that incriminating airport recording. Or was it incriminating?
You never did ask him, though, if he had shot and killed Trent, did you?
Why would I when he'd already told me? And if I said to him, did you kill Trent? When he already knew he told me 5 years ago, he would have known that I was there, in fact, to
set him up?
To get him to admit it.
Hadn't you rehearsed that?
Rehearsed what?
With Detective Evans and others. Don't give him an opportunity to deny that he had shot Trent.
No.
Had the defense planted a seed of reasonable doubt? Maybe. The jury adjourned to think about it, and Trent's friends waited.
I've never been so terrified and so scared in my life.
Uh-huh. Your heart's going 100 miles an hour. And
100 miles an hour.
And 5 hours later,
we, the jury, find the defendant guilty of intentional murder.
Guilty of intentional murder. The sentence, 30 years.
To know that he was guilty, know that this guy who's sitting there smug and non-remorseful is guilty and found guilty, and boom, you feel good about that.
Mike DeGiro thought it was done.
Okay, this is it. He's going to jail. It's over.
And Amy? She had vanished.
Amy was afraid of Shane Ragland. And we told her that if she testified, we would do what we could to let her have a new identity. And law enforcement helped her get a new identity.
And that new identity would be a problem.
You talk about something that just blows you away. I mean, I couldn't even grasp that.
Because this case wasn't over. Not even close.
Coming up, a stunning reversal.
And I know I'm innocent.
Will there ever be justice for Trent?
It's, oh, wow, here we go all over again.
It was early spring in Kentucky when justice was done for the murder of Trent DeGiro, thanks, his friends knew, to a woman who faced up to fear and told her story.
We've never met Amy, and I am eternally grateful to
Absolutely.
Amy for everything that she's done for not only Trent and his family, but for us.
Except there was an appeal. Of course there was, standard procedure. But what happened? was not standard at all. A court reversed the jury's decision.
Any comments, Shane?
And Shane Ragland went home on $1 million bail paid by his dad to wait for a whole new trial.
It's been a long time, Shane.
To be outside, be going home with your father right now.
I don't really look at it like that. I look at the long-term goal of fighting a case against me that's fake, that's false, and they know I'm innocent. And so I don't worry about my feelings, creature comforts.
Why was the verdict thrown out? It had nothing to do with Amy Lloyd or her explosive testimony or the sting tape recorded at the airport. All that was fine. So what was the issue? The bullet that killed Trent. An FBI expert had linked the fragments of that bullet found during the autopsy to bullets like these that were found in Shane's father's house. But after Shane's conviction, the FBI realized the test it used was in fact bad science and stopped using it.
These are things that we've been arguing for years, frankly, shouldn't have been admitted.
And the court agreed with the defense.
When this reversal happened, what was that like?
Well, it was a blow. I mean, it was a real blow.
Kind of an irony, isn't it? It was one of the smaller pieces of evidence.
In my mind, yes.
When what you thought was done gets undone, what does it do to you?
Oh, wow, here we go all over again. We've got to go through this yet another time. And the yet another time we realized pretty quickly was going to be without some key evidence.
Yeah.
Amy Lloyd wasn't coming back.
No, Amy Lloyd was not going to testify a second time. That was the deal she made. Testify once, then disappear.
There was no way to bring her back. Because once someone has that level of cover, you can't undo it, bring them back.
And then do it again.
And then do it again.
No option but to make a deal. Shane got to plead guilty to second-degree manslaughter.
And did you, in fact, commit the crime that you are pleading guilty to?
Yes, I did.
Which meant that, at least, he now admitted to firing that fatal shot.
And I thought, well, plea bargains. He, you know, spends another 10 years in jail. I'm not too bad with that.
Oh, but it wasn't 10 more years, wasn't any more years. He got the time he'd already served. 5 years, plus just 3 days of house arrest.
Three more days.
He walked out of the courtroom, went home. And that really chapped my ass.
It did help a little, said Mike DeGiro. When he successfully sued Shane in civil court for wrongful death, the jury awarded him $63 million, later reduced to $33 million. No matter, said Mike. He hasn't received a penny, doesn't expect to. But money was never the point.
He's never really accepted responsibility for what he did.
Shane went on with his life. And then a few years later, he was involved in a serious car accident. He's in a wheelchair now and was back in court on an unrelated case. And what about Amy? If that's even her name now.
How's she doing now?
She's living a new life.
What'd she do? You want to tell me anything at all?
I'm sorry, but I'm not going to be able to tell you anything about her current life.
At all.
As for Mike, he had a choice, he knew. He could sink into bitterness, or...
So where do you put your frustrations over this?
Well, what has come from all this is we consider very positive thing.
The Trent DeGiro Foundation has awarded nearly 100 scholarships to walk-on football players and others at the University of Kentucky and at local high schools. Young people with determination and personal courage, just like Trent.
You'll never make any sense of his death, but you can make sense of his life.
We can make sense of what we've done to commemorate Trent, to remember Trent, and giving these young folks an opportunity Trent won't have.
That's a whole other story. But.
And remarkably, Trent's friends remain exceedingly close, even all these years after that shot in the dark.
You feel like family now.
Well, they are family. I think it says so much about what Trent meant to these kids, young adults now, and what they mean to us. It's been a blessing to us.
They all get together and laugh and tell stories. And imagine
who would he have become as an adult? And gosh, I'm sure it would have been magnificent, just as he was as a teenager. I'm kind of pissed that I don't get to meet his wife or meet his kids or, oh gosh, share all the adult things that we've had the opportunity to share with each other. But I think, you know, when I get rid of those like base feelings, you know, the underlying feeling is just of gratitude that he was in my life, even for a brief moment in time.
That's all for now. I'm Lester Holt. Thanks for joining us.